Vom 15. Juli bis zum 18. August ist das Lora in der Sommerpause. In der letzten Woche von der Sommerpause hört ihr das Endlos Sounds. 120 Stunden Live-Musik aus verschiedenen Orten in Zürich und natürlich auch immer auf 97,5 MHz. Bis dann spielen wir euch die besten Sendungen vom letzten Jahr.
Tauchen wir ein ins Archiv.
36 Grad und es wird noch heißer.
So we are here with the dear friend we met in Paranoia City, Edwige René from bookshop and library and residency in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire, which is called 1949 Books.
Yes.
Welcome. It's really nice that you were here.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure to meet you at Paranoia City.
Yeah, it's a good spot to meet.
It's a place to go.
Yes. And we decided to come here together to talk about your bookshop, your visions of the feminist movement, your visit here, the reason for your visit here, and also why your bookshop is called, or your project is called 1949 Books. So there's a lot to talk about today.
Yes.
Do you want to start?
Yes, maybe we can start with you introducing yourself and already talking about why you're here, in what context you're here in Zurich.
Yes, so I am Edwige René, as you mentioned. I am from Côte d'Ivoire. How do I introduce myself in a way that is easier? So I am a writer. I have written some short stories. I am a literary translator. And I like to define myself as a literary activist in that I use literature for activism. I am in Zurich since the 5th of June, quite a while now. And I am here because LITA, the association that invited me here in November, decided to scout out militant literary scenes in Africa, and they worked with me, so 1949 Books, the library of women's writings from Africa and the Black World, which I set up in 2020, and they also worked with LOTAD, the Library of Africa and the African Diaspora in Ghana. So they work with those two organizations. So now we have an exhibition that is running until September, actually. So yeah, check it out. So that's why I'm here in Zurich.
Mm-hmm. This label of literary activist, it's what you call yourself, right?
Yes.
How did you find to this name or label?
Yeah, you know, because I am a writer. I think that's the only thing I know how to do. I love literature, but I came to I did not train as a literary translator. And I always say I'm a literary translator. I translate literature. But I in 2014 I won a big prize, and with alongside 39 other writers under the age of 40. The prize is called Africa 39, and we went to Nigeria. Now, 2014 was also the year we were talking about, you know, Africa Rising, the Africa Rising movement, just because the Economist has now said that we were the hopeful continent and no longer the hopeless continent. And I went there and I just realized that our literature is still contained within our linguistic borders. You know, so Côte d'Ivoire knows about Côte d'Ivoire. We don't know what is happening in Burkina Faso. We really don't know about what's happening in Senegal, unless France has said, this is a big writer. And we're like, oh yeah, this is a big writer. And I'm like, we cannot be talking about Africa Rising or the development of Africa if we're not even hearing what we are saying about each other. And that's how I got into translating literature, actually. So literature, really, from the continent. What are the writers who are the voice of a country, of a continent, saying about their place? What are the reflections that are going on? So I use, you know, literature as activism. How are we even translating the things we are translating? You know, who is big? Who is important? How do we decide who is important? So all of those questions, and slowly led to, 1949 books.
Mm. It's really interesting. I'm wondering, maybe that's my perspective because I know way less than you, but to me it feels like French is also kind of a colonial language, and the like understanding each other or translating literature across like one country's borders is still dependent on this, for example, is kind of crazy a little bit to me.
You know, I hear what you are saying, as I like to actually joke with people. You know that Chinua Achebe saying, we will take the English language and we will do with it what, you know, we want to do with it. For me, I do not consider French a colonial language. One, because Côte d'Ivoire, my country, officially became a French colony in 1893. I don't think that in 1890, you know, the French people sat down in Paris or wherever they sat down and said, okay, we are going to, you know, colonize this country and we're going to develop this language called French. And then we are going to go there and this is just the language you're going to use for this purpose. It is a language that was used. And then they came. Nobody invited them. And then we use that language for ourselves. Of course, and this is where the activism comes into literature. It is the French that I even choose to translate in. It is the fact that I will not italicize some words, you know, because me saying Gbaka or Garba or Achieke or Aloko, you know, nobody's ever gone and explained what hamburger is. Nobody said, you know, it is, you know, patty with beef or whatever. So I will not explain aloko. You will just realize, and I will not italicize. I will not put a glossary at the end because it is my language. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody invited you. you know, through beating, you got my grandparent, my great grandparent to learn this language. And maybe not my parent, but my great grandparent, to learn this language. So it is mine. And I will do with it what I want to do with it. And I will speak it in a way that I want to speak it. You know, I will not wait. So it is in that sense that for me, it is not a colonial language. Mm-hmm. So I'm not waiting for the Académie Française to kind of validate the French I am speaking. And I think musicians in Africa, in Francophone Africa, have done it well. Now, what we need to do is to do that in literature. And this is what I would love to see, you know, happening in literature. That we do not care. But the reason why we care, maybe, and I agree with you on that colonial stuff, is because we are still reliant on Paris in some of our cases, and to some extent on London, on New York, to validate our literature. The day we will have developed a market within the continent, we won't even care about, you know, trying to explain what Aloko is, what Achike is. And as you are noticing, I'm not even explaining what that is, you know.
Should I go for the next question? In your introduction, you talked about the militant literary scene. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about how this looks like in your bookshop or in your residency programs or in your library, how this scene comes together and how it was maybe also inspired by people that came before them.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So it is militant in a sense that, well, you know, we choose to focus on women's writings. I've been wanting to set up a library since 2016. And it had to be like African literature. But then, which African literature? I didn't want people to come to my library and choose the same books they have chosen, you know, books by main writer whom they know. So I wanted to, yeah, focus on women's writings from Africa and the Black world. So that's in one sense, that's militant. It is also militant with regards to where the library is. The library is not in the supposed center of Abidjan, in a bourgeois neighborhood, you know, which is called Kokodi. It is, right now the infrastructure is better, but when I was setting up, it was 1 hour and 10 minutes away. When there is traffic, 45 minutes, when there is no traffic, from the supposed center. And I call it the supposed center because, you know, it is supposed. Many people ask me, oh, but why do you have the library here? It is far. And I was like, far from whom? You know, like, why do you think it is far? And it's quite interesting because recently I found out that this Kokodi area, which is the bourgeois neighborhood, well, not as bourgeois as Zurich, but, you know, bourgeois by our standard, which is also called the presidential neighborhood because that's where the president's residence is, official and also unofficial, hasn't got a public library. You know, I mean, it isn't that there are many libraries in Côte d'Ivoire anyway. There are about 20 libraries, but it hasn't got a library. So I'm like, why is it the center of things? Do you think that having a variety of restaurants, you know, makes this the center of the place? And what kind of elite doesn't read, you know? Some might say that, oh, the elite have the library in their homes. But if you are really a reader, it will overflow so much so that you set up a space for other people to come in. So it is militant in a sense that of where I set up the library. The library is in Yopougon. Mm. It is a neighborhood, one of the 10th neighborhood of Abidjan. It has 1.5 million people. It is the biggest neighborhood in Côte d'Ivoire. Biggest even than the second biggest city in Côte d'Ivoire, which is Bouaké, with less than 500,000 people. So, and also like Yopougon, because today it has the image of a lower socioeconomic neighborhood. But I always say when it was set up in the 70s, this is the neighborhood of the new Ivorian elite, not the children of, you know, we call them les enfants de, not the children of, but the children of nobodies. The nobodies who worked in plantation, who sent their children to school, sometimes the first intellectual in a sense, in a Western sense, of their families. So they are there. So the university professors used to live there. It is also Yopougon that brought what I call the Democratic Côte d'Ivoire. In 1990, the multi-party system was born there. It is a disruptive neighborhood in a good sense, but this history is lost. And I think it is good that a library that is also seeking to be disruptive is there so that people come in. Otherwise, they will never come in. They want to say, and I want to decenter the conversations around women's contribution, around feminism. What exactly is feminism when we think about it in, you know, in our context? And in every context, actually, you know, sometimes, you know, the movement, in my view anyway, is getting somewhat diluted. We are turning away from it being a political movement to thinking that it is, you know, a girl boss movement. And I'm like, no, it is not. Like, it's not hard to be a girl boss if you have all the privilege. If you have all the privilege and you find it hard to be a girl boss, what kind of girl boss are you? you know. And we need to remember that it is a political movement. It is political. So for me, it was important that it is there. When we say we are feminists and we are in some bougie neighborhood, what kind of feminism is that? Why do I want to talk with people who look like me? You know, I want to also, especially when you have half of the population in Côte d'Ivoire that does not read or write French or any of the other 63 languages of the country, but where we speak French a lot. I want to hear them in their French, how they use French, because I can use every type of French. Like, I'm sure if I go to Lausanne, I'll speak French like a Parisian. But what about a woman who hasn't gone to Lausanne, hasn't gone to Paris, in that French that she speaks, you know, with words, or even in that French that she does not speak, how does she understand feminism? How does it speak to her? And, you know, how do we make feminist theory accessible to the market women, to the women who are hawking goods, you know, in the traffic jams of Abidjan, to the women living in the north, you know, to everybody. So I think this is one of the thing that I'm really working at the moment. What does intersectionality looks like really in Africa? Not a case of, you know, white and black women. This is too big. It is like within Côte d'Ivoire, what does it look like? What does it look like to be intersectional, even between me and my mother? Me who, you know, has been educated to the UK, is traveling, does, you know, and my mother who didn't go to school, who cannot read and write, but whom, thanks to her, I was able to go and study to all of those places. I cannot come today and play and, you know, speak about feminism in my big, big French or my big, big English to her. I think she will just look at me like, what do you know? You know, and I am interested in what those women like my mother who didn't go to school, women my age who have not had the same privileges that I've had, any women really, you know, women younger than me, you know, how are they grasping feminism? What does it mean for them? Mm. Yeah.
That was really interesting listening to you.
Thank you.
And I think we're at a quite similar point in Switzerland with the feminist movement or a political movement, also connecting with like maybe different generations and remembering the fights that our ancestors and people before us also did, and how we can connect them to today.
Yeah.
Yes, and to fights. And I think it's in one way really enriching, but also sometimes for me this is draining, because I feel like we haven't progressed sometimes.
I know, yeah. Sometimes I feel like our generation, yeah, we need to connect to what went on before us.
Mm.
You know, we shouldn't think that we are doing the whole thing. And I think that's why I spent so much time at Paranoia City that time you met me. Because this is a space that is nourishing, that is trying to connect the movement, you know, in a global sense, you know, to what it is. There are books written by women of every hue and tones there, you know, what we call black, white, yellow, brown, just because, it's, you know, because the classification is just, you know, one of those things that people gave. So it is nice to connect the fight. I sometimes joke with people, detractors of the feminist movement in my country, and they are saying, oh, but these feminists, as a feminist is an insult, you know, they call you, oh, you're a feminist, and you're like, yes, why am I? I mean, you know, in the same way people say no is a complete sentence, yes is also a complete sentence, you know, it is your, why should I take on your burden? You know, if you think feminist is an insult, I don't think it is an insult. I will not say yes, but I will not justify myself. Yes, I am a feminist. Let's talk about that. You know, or sometimes I say, oh yeah, but women of today, they are so materialistic. They are not like our mothers. And I think this is one of actually the work that 1949 does. I'm like, they are not like our mothers. How? Because generation of feminist detractors have spent their life denigrating the women of the contemporary women and idealizing the women who were before. You know, so when they tell me, oh yeah, but you are not like our mothers, and we are developing a project at the library actually around that, we call them our mothers. Because which mothers are you talking about? Do you know that in the 70s, there were newspaper articles saying that, you know, Ivorian women are asking for the free V's. And the free V's were, and I'll say it in French and I'll translate, the free V's were the villa, the la voiture, le virement. And the villa is obviously the villa house, la voiture, the car, and the bank transfer. And I was like, so you should, you know, we are not like our mothers. You know, we are not going we are not listening to our mothers. We are not asking them questions. And that's why sometimes the discouragement comes like, oh my God, what must we do? Because, you know, being a rebel is a good thing. We need to be rebel. Sometimes we are putting on the burden on us, and sometimes people are putting on the burden that, yeah, but, you know, I don't know if it's the same here, but, you know, we do not know about feminism. But if you could explain it to us, I mean, our generation, if you want podcasts, you can get podcasts. If you want, there is Google to tell you what feminism is. You can learn. So if you are not doing it and you are putting that burden on me to explain it to you, and we're like, yeah, but, you know, we must include men in a movement. No, we must be rebels. You know, we must be rebel. We shouldn't be like, yeah, but maybe he doesn't understand. We're like, no, you're an idiot. You do not understand. Because when they want to find out how to change, oh, I don't know, something in a car, they will watch YouTube videos, go to Google, talk to their friends, and suddenly when it comes to feminism, nobody knows what to do. And then another supplementary work is given to women to educate them. I think every woman should refuse to educate men. When we do that, they will step out. It's because we are not doing it yet. We are like mollycoddling them, like, oh, well, you know, I don't know, poor men. And I think, you know, and we need to be able to tell people, you are shit. You know, like, sometimes we try to, you know, we do things where we are like, oh, no, we don't want to offend. We don't want to. No, people are shit. They are shit. And we need to tell them. And then we need to be rebel. We need to learn. So we need to learn from those movement that went on before that. How did they do their disruption? What can we learn from the disruptive movement? You know, they worked at a time when they didn't have internet, Facebook group, WhatsApp group, any of these groups. Yet they managed to, you know, to lead strike that, that brought cities to stand hill. You were talking about the 1999, you know, strike in, in Switzerland. Like in 1999, they didn't have WhatsApp, you know, but they manage.
It was even in 1991.
Yeah, exactly.
Even older, yeah.
It's yeah, crazy. Exactly. And they manage. Mm-hmm. And we need to learn from them. We need to, and you know, and that's why I have like 1949. For those women who wrote, those who were privileged enough to write, because some of their books or their thoughts are not there anymore, you know. And the mission of the library is to unearth and amplify the contributions of African and Black women. I focus on African and Black women because sometimes people are like, oh no, feminism is not an African thing. I mean, I'm like, for goodness sake, we are the cradle of humanity. Everything started in Africa, even feminism. So, but, you know, it is to unearth because the contributions have been buried. So we first of all, we need to unearth, and then we need to amplify in whichever way is necessary to, you know, to amplify, whether it is through, you know, literary curation, if it is through podcasts, if it's through conversations. Anyway, how were, you know, women before us organizing, you know, you know, maybe they're just meeting in a coffee shop. Let's do that. Why must we always want to hire halls and have these big meetings? You know, let's meet individually in little groups. Maybe that's what they were doing. So let's do that, mm-hmm. You know, and maybe add our own intelligence to it.
Thank you, Edwige René, for putting this emphasis on connecting and communicating through language, translating, and literature. 1949 books seems to be a place that brings all of that together. You told us about the different functions of the space. It is a library on one hand, but also a bookshop on the other, and also a residency. So you do a lot. You do also a lot of work, everything. But in the pre-talk, we also talked about refusal as a powerful and political tool. And I wanted to ask if you want to explain a little bit more on that now.
Yeah, I think some of the refusal is also refusing to convince anybody. But of course, one of the values of the library is creativity. So we have we have excellence, we have professionalism, we have fun, we have creativity, and we have compassion. Those are the five values of 1949, that in whatever we do, we need to have lot of compassion, lot of excellence, lot of creativity. So in a sense that I will not convince anybody, but the flip side of that is that we have to be excellent. So one example, I went with one of my person who works with me, and we were in our neighborhood talking about the libraries, what we do, you know, the contributions of women and the programs that we do, reading to children age 5 to 10, about books written by black women from every country in the world. And if there is no black women in that particular country, I don't know if Antarctica counts, then we find a woman. In any case, the stories have to be written by women, and sometimes even illustrated by women. And we were talking about different program, and he was excited. He was like, yeah, that's a great idea. I will send my child, absolutely. And as we were turning to leave, on the back of the T-shirt, it is written, obviously, La Bibliothèque des Écritures Féminines d'Afrique du Monde Noir. So the Library of Women's Writings from Africa and the Black World. It was like, oh my God, this is your feminism. I don't think I'm going to send my child there. And I just said, okay. You know, okay, it's fine. Just say okay. But, and of course, the person I worked with was like, but you know, I don't even know if we're going to get any children. I was like, oh, even if we get one child, we will do it so well. We're going to do it so well. We will select the right books. So every book at the library, maybe about 10 or something, I have read them all. So it's like, we will select the right books. We will hire a storyteller. We're not just going to mumble these words. We will be excellent. And then, so that father later on, you know, if he came and paid the subscription fee, which is not even a lot, which is like maybe 10 Swiss franc a year. So it doesn't cover any of the thing with you, because let's say I pay the storyteller 30 Swiss francs a year. That's why I'm always working. I work like mad hours just to be able, because I use my personal fund to fund the library. So through the programming, we also focus a lot, even our book club, it is very oral. So it is, the book club is book club for people who read and who don't read. And the idea is actually to select extract from the books to discuss it in a big context of what is happening in a country. Basically put feminism topic. Because feminism, like women's topic, what people call women's topic is not women's topic. Recently we've had a spate of development, like we want to develop the country. And it's always interesting when we say that in an African context, what does it mean? Building roads, building bridges, you know, in a city like Abidjan, there are no pedestrian pathways. And I'm like, why? We all don't have cars. So you need to include that. Why are you building a lot of roads for the cars to go on? And you're not putting any green in a city when we are getting temperatures because of climate change reaching 40 degrees in Abidjan, and you cannot walk in this city. if you walk, it's because you do not have money for transportation. Why are we being so mean towards our own selves? And then the people, and you have not developed the rest